to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. When it comes to making things on the tiny scale of nanometers, the laws of physics take on a mind of their own. ICOR professor Dr. Mark Freeman is trying to understand what those new nano rules are. And if your house doesn't face the sunny side of the street, have no fear. You can still put in solar power. You just need to be a little inventive. In the case of 87-year-old Eric Steeden of Edmonton, he built an arbor in his garden and covered that with solar panels. He now powers his house and still has more than enough to feed back into the electrical grid. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Some of the most mysterious scientific work from a layperson's perspective is taking place in the field of nanotechnology. And yet, Alberta is fast becoming a leader in this frontier. Dr. Mark Freeman is a professor of physics at the University of Alberta. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Condensed Matter Physics, and he's supported in much of his research by ICOR, the Informatics Circle for Research Excellence. Mark is collaborating with computing and electrical engineer Dr. Michael Brett in the area of nanofabrication, and he's coming up with some interesting notions about the way atoms and molecules behave on the nanoscale. This is important because these things simply don't behave the way you'd expect according to the classical laws of physics. I started by asking Mark about these nano properties in relation to quantum physics.
What we're studying here are really the building blocks of nanotechnologies. What's very interesting to physicists is that as you make structures smaller and smaller, at some point it seems you always enter a regime where the properties become different, that they actually become influenced by the presence of boundaries, or the fact that the material doesn't extend off to long distances in every direction. And a tried and true example, long-term example of this is even in just simple electrical conduction. If I make a resistor to go in some electrical circuit, if I make the resistor out of big enough materials, then I know that the resistance is just determined really by the shape of the thing, by its length and its width, and there's just a number associated with it that I can calculate, and that'll dictate the resistance. But as I start making the thing smaller, at some point, the fact that electrons, also as they're going through the resistor, bounce off the surface, can alter the resistance that you measure, okay? That there can be, a little bit more or less resistance depending on exactly what happens at the surface when the electrons bounce off. And that's been known for a very long time. But as you shrink even further, you actually enter a regime where you have to begin to worry about the fact that electrons do have wave-like property as well as particle-like property. So this is the quantum mechanics that you're asking about. And indeed, in the 1980s, there was a lot of work on this with little metal wires, even on the micron scale. If you make wires out of clean metal and you cool them to low temperatures, the wave properties of the electrons extend over long enough distances that then, if you go to measure a resistance, the resistance isn't even determined anymore totally by the geometry and the surfaces, okay? That you almost have to think about the electron waves sitting in a structure kind of like even water waves in a ripple tank or something, that if I add additional structures kind of outside where my wire is but still electrically connected, that they will also affect the resistance, okay? Even though if it were a bigger classical thing, that part of the structure would have no effect. And it turns out that sort of behavior really generalizes to most physical properties, in fact. That one of the things that's really neat about nanoscience is that the characteristic length scales for these quantum mechanical effects in for many phenomena, electronic and magnetic and chemical and other things, are on the nanometer scale. So we see new properties emerging when we look at structures that are that small.
Well, does this mean then when you're trying to work on the nanoscale that things don't work the way you think they're going to?
Well, not always, right? And that's what makes it the most exciting, is when there are surprises. And usually, if one finds something that doesn't behave the way you necessarily expect, that also creates an opportunity to hopefully exploit it in some way in technology later on. But the main emphasis of our work in physics is still in just trying to kind of scope out the range of different behaviors that exist.
You're also working with Dr. Michael Brett, and you're combining the physics and the electrical components, electrical engineering, to deal with things on the nanoscale. What is it that you're actually trying to do, the two of you, with this collaboration?
Well, the main overlap of our interest comes together at the level of nanofabrication, okay? That for us in physics to study these building blocks that we're interested in, I mean, we can't do that unless we have a way to make them with very high precision. And we've worked together a lot in developing the technology for producing these things with very high precision and with nanometer scale resolution, and so that's we have common interests there in producing the nanostructures, and then we tend to do relatively different things with them. Mike is working more immediately in producing nanomaterials and exploring their applications, where we're making smaller quantities of little things and then trying to do very specialized physical measurements on them to understand the way they behave.
How do you actually observe or measure these things if they're so small?
Okay. That's a great question. We tend to use microscopies still. And what's, again, incredibly exciting is that there is an ongoing revolution in microscopy, again, even though it's a field that's now almost 400 years old, but driven by advances in manufacturing optics, and especially in sources of light, lasers and other nanotechnologies for controlling how light can be propagated. Optical microscopy can do astounding things that no one would have suspected even 20 or 30 years ago. And so
can you give me an example?
Sure. In my group, more specifically, we're interested in how the nanosystems behave as a function of time if you dump in a little bit of extra energy, okay? And one example to try and motivate that I sometimes use is if you just imagine something like a soccer ball or something like that, and suppose you have a soccer ball sitting in front of you on the desk there, and all you can do is look at it, you can say a lot of things. You could write a paper on the property of soccer balls sitting on a desk in what I would call an equilibrium. Okay, you could describe its shape and sort of what it looks like and whatnot, but that wouldn't tell you anything about its sort of dynamic properties. The things that you'd be interested in about a soccer ball to predict, say, how it would actually behave in a game of soccer, right? If somebody kicks it, what's going to happen? And I could easily then, if I could sort of advance my inspection technology so that, say, if I'm going to drop the soccer ball on the floor or something and watch it bounce and And then, say, take pictures very quickly as it bounces off the floor and see how its shape distorts and all this kind of stuff. That way I can learn, you know, all the things that I actually need to know about the soccer ball to describe, you know, how well it's going to work in a game. And what we can do with these microscopies now is much like if I had a flash camera. Well, your camera there with the flash, the flash on that camera, I think it has a flash, right? It's actually probably fast enough, even if we could time it just right, to see the distortion of the soccer ball when it hits the floor. We could probably get a pretty crisp image of that. But what goes on in our small electrical and magnetic devices is sometimes even a billion times faster than what you could flash, you know, with your camera and get a crisp image without blurring.
How do you do that?
Well, you do that now with lasers. So there have been, you know, great advances in laser technology over the last 20 years, and now you can make flashes that will essentially freeze that sort of motion. And so that's one of the things now that you can do with microscopes that you couldn't before is replace the light bulb that illuminates your specimen with one of these amazing lasers and take this sort of flash picture.
What would you say is the most exciting thing that you've seen or discovered in the last little while?
Well, I think the most exciting thing that we've accomplished in the recent past has been mapping out this correspondence between modeling and experimental measurements of what we call micromagnetic dynamics. I mean, the most exciting thing that I've seen, though, and the most exciting thing that we're involved in now, right at this immediate moment, is with a new tool that we have in the laboratory that is going to be part of the foundation for carrying this research on to this next step into the quantum world, among other things, and that is that we have a very special kind of microscope now that actually allows us to study individual atoms and molecules, and also to manipulate them, to move them around on surfaces and build artificial structures with them. So it's a different kind. It's not an optical microscope like I was talking about before. It's called a scanning tunneling microscope that images things with electrons, but not with an electron beam like in an ordinary electron microscope, but by supplying the electrical current with essentially just a very sharp needle that's, you know, in some ways related to the stylus in an old record player, but it's very, very sharp, and you can control it so that you're really only passing electrical current between essentially the last atom on the end of the needle and the closest atom to it on the surface. And by scanning the needle around, you can take a picture of the surface with pretty high resolution. I mean, our microscope downstairs, which is kind of a, you know, world-class commercial instrument, although people are able to build custom instruments that are even better. But what we're talking about here, it's becoming, you know, sort of routine almost in this business now, is measuring the height of a surface with a resolution that's just equal to about 1/100th of the diameter of an atom. Okay, so you can start taking pictures where, you know, individual atoms almost start looking like mountains. Okay, it's just mind-boggling. And the characteristic of the microscope that we have, it operates in what you call ultra-high vacuum, so there's no atoms or molecules flying around, you know, in sort of a gas phase in the thing. So nothing lands on the surface. If you prepare a clean surface, it stays clean essentially forever. It's also cooled to liquid helium temperatures so that essentially any relative motion that you would get between the needle and the surface due to temperature changes are completely frozen out. And so you can more or less steer the thing, say, to park above a given atom or molecule, and it will stay there for days if you have to, you know, to do measurements on that structure. And so this technology, we've also developed a technique for combining that sort of microscopy with the laser flashing sort of approach to make these non-equilibrium measurements with atomic resolution. And having this new tool to do that is certainly the thing that I'm, you know, extremely excited about at the moment.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Okay, thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Dr. Mark Freeman, a professor of physics at the University of Alberta. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Condensed Matter Physics, and he's a senior research fellow of the ICOR Nanoscale Engineering Physics Initiative. We haven't been getting much sun these days, given the unusually cloudy and cool weather for June. But that hasn't dampened the spirits of those converts to solar power. I recently met Eric Steeden when I participated in the Edmonton Eco Solar Home Tour. Eric is 87 years old. He's lived in the same home in Westmount since the end of World War II. A few months ago, he commissioned Howell Mayhew Engineering to design a solar-powered system for his house. They came up with an arbor that runs in an east-west direction from the house to the garage. It's trellised on the north side, and 16 solar panels are mounted on the south.
To start with, the people that I was contacting with for solar power had in mind was going to put it on the house. The roof has kind of got odd shape, so that was out. The south side of the house didn't suit the potential that was visible after they seen the size of my yard. So they said, we're going to put it in the yard over your sidewalk between the house and the garage. And that's the way it ended up.
What is it constructed from?
The uprights are 4x4s. The beams and whatnot are 2x6s, which I thought was at the time quite substantial. But since then, I've been told or informed in my own observation, the 4x4s could have probably been 6x6s in a setup like this here. This happens to be a fairly large setups, so it, for safety's sake, it probably should have been just a little heavier, but so far I've had no problems.
Now you have the solar panels out here on the trellis or the arbor. How does the power get into the house? What did you have to do in order to hook it up to your house?
Well, that's up to the electricians, and they don't have any trouble finding ways to get the electricity into the house. From this panel here, it goes underground to a connection to the house to a meter, my meter, and from my meter it goes downstairs to what they call an inverter. And from the inverter, it goes to the breaker box, which also gets the feed from EPCOR Power. That's where the surplus power goes back into the grid from that.
Are you actually putting power into the grid?
Oh, yes, especially in the wintertime. Summertime, I figure I make twice what I use.
Well, you've been living in this house all these years, and how old are you?
87.
87, and you've been living here since the 1940s. Why have you decided to put solar power into your property?
Innovation, curiosity. And I'm not scared to tackle something that I'm interested in. So I just all of a sudden made up my mind we're going to have solar.
What got you interested in solar?
Wind in Saskatchewan. I have relatives in southern Saskatchewan. They was talking about wind power. And after coming back from a holiday, this is only this recently, within the last three couple of years, I've been thinking solo. Wind power in the city is a no-no. So solar is the next best thing, and it's the most friendly and economical ecology system of electricity that a person can get a hold of.
How much did it cost you?
Less than $30,000.
Do you think that that's a good investment?
A very good investment. I maybe never live long enough to get the benefit of it, but my family will, I think.
You've had an awful lot of people come through here today looking at your system on this EcoSolar home tour. What does that say to you about other people's interests in using this type of energy?
I was surprised the number of people that was actually thoroughly interested in solar. Possibly, without them seeing it, I doubt if they had a clue as to the availability of such a system. You don't see very many systems in this country that's outside, apart from being tied up to buildings or the likes of that. This one is separate from all buildings whatsoever.
What have the neighbors said?
They like it. They like it. There's no complaints from the neighbors whatsoever.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Eric Steeden of Edmonton. Down in Eric's basement, where the power panel and inverter are located, I talked with engineer Gordon Howell of Howell Mayhew Engineering.
Well, we developed the whole project, so we gave him a turnkey system. He came and knocked on our door and wanted a system, so we talked with him about where it should go, and we designed it, and we got the suppliers together and the electrician and worked through the approvals process and then turned it on.
How's it working today? We've got the power panel here. What's happening? What's it saying?
Well, it's saying that it's producing 340 watts right now. So he's probably producing, 80% of his electricity at this moment. And it's a cloudy day, but when it was raining, it was probably only producing 20%. But now it's coming up.
What are the challenges you faced in putting this in?
One of the challenges that we had with this project is that the solar power system produces too much electricity on any sunny day of the year and generates and runs the excess electricity back into the power wires. We wanted the ability to be able to turn the meter backwards because the normal meters do turn backwards. So we wanted this meter to be able to turn backwards. But the power company and the regulators and the Alberta government steadfastly refused to allow us to do this. And so that was an issue that we dealt with. At this point, it has a meter which doesn't go backwards at all, but we're using it as a case example.
What would be the advantage of having it go backwards?
Well, if it goes backwards, then you can get a credit for the excess electricity you produce at the same rate that you would be buying the electricity from the utility company.
Oh, so they don't want you to get something for free?
Well, it's actually the other way around. They want to get something for free. Because they are getting, right now, they are getting the electricity that is going back into the power lines. They're actually not paying for it. And yet they are then selling this very same electricity to the neighbors for full price without themselves having paid for it.
Do you see this changing in the future?
Well, it must change. Other parts of the world have laws that facilitate this technology and allow meters to go backwards. So, yes, it must change because this technology and other similar ones aren't going to go away.
What's the other challenge you have?
Well, the word challenge is a good point. One of the ones was the fact that this inverter generates electricity at 240 volts AC, which is compatible with our house electricity. But it doesn't have a neutral wire going into the inverter. Now, we explained to the inspector how it would work, in fact, that the neutral current would be provided by the transformer that EPCOR owns, but he didn't believe that on site, so he had to go back to the office and look at it for about a week, and then he accepted that our assessment of it was valid. But if we didn't have that technical specialty to stand our ground on this, would he have written it off? Would he have actually served the project by still going and saying it was okay or what? So it comes down to whose job is it to train the inspectors? Is it the normal average everyday person who puts in these novel technologies? Or is it the inspectors that should see the technologies are coming down the line and then do the work themselves to prepare themselves to inspect these systems and to understand how they work? And that comment goes to the utility companies and the regulators too.
Right now, Mr. Steeden doesn't have batteries to store his electricity that he's generating, but is there the potential to have that here on this system?
Well, a solar power system with batteries is actually quite a different configuration than this one here. This one here uses an inverter called a solar-powered inverter. So the solar power array actually feeds the inverter directly, which then feeds the breaker panel directly, and then the electricity just goes into the house. If you have batteries, then the solar power system feeds the batteries, charges the batteries, and the inverter works off the batteries. So it's called a battery-powered inverter. And then that inverter then feeds the house. So it's quite a different inverter, and there's other things you have to do with the solar power system in terms of putting on a charge regulator to make sure that the electricity is looked after okay.
Outside on the trellis, there are 16 solar panels. Why 16?
Oh, well, it's a number that fit with the budget, and the inverter is quite flexible in that it can take a range of solar modules all connected in series. So really that one was sized to fit with the budget and the size of the trellis.
For people who are thinking of installing something like this in their homes, what should they consider in terms of a budget? What range of money?
Well, you can start small and work to whatever size you want. The smallest solar power system that's grid connected that I've seen would cost in around $1,500 or so. And then you can add multiples of that together. But there's another chap that I have seen near Pigeon Lake who has a $10,000 system. He has a large inverter and a small number of solar modules, and so every time he gets some more money, he puts on more solar modules without changing anything else in the system. So that's a good thing to do. But you could have a system that's as large as you want. According to the size of your garden, the size of your house roof, the size of your wallet, whatever it is that would set the maximum.
Thank you very much, Gordon.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Gordon Howell of Howell Mayhew Engineering, specialists in solar power designs. I also spoke with homeowner Eric Steeden. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, Science Alberta Foundation, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.